All right, welcome in, everybody. It is Inside the Gamecocks, the show portion of the ITG Superstream. Final hour of the show, final day of the week, and that, of course, means we've got Late Night come to town with the king of late night himself, Matt Anderson, is in. Sorry for the delayed crossover there, because we finally did get some information, guys, out of SEC Media Days with the polls. But welcome in, Matt. Good to see you, JC, and yeah, we got some South Carolina names on these all SEC preseason team lists.
Yes, two of them. You got
the most predictable too.
Yeah, Stewart first team, Harbor.
Yeah,
or, well, Harbor third. So look at all these teams ahead of Carolina.
Yeah, the Carolina is slotted as 11th. Is this the media? Media, yeah. So this is not the coaches poll.
Oklahoma 7th. There's people talking about them winning the national championship.
I don't know.
I mean, Alabama 6th, LSU 5th.
I don't think the media knows what to do with the transfer portal. I really don't.
No, they don't. They really don't, you know.
Well, and you also have to consider, like, what is considered media in this poll is, I mean, could be a lot of bloggers, just bloggers, podcasters.
So where was Bama?
6th.
6th, yeah.
Wow.
It goes like this. It goes Georgia 1. I would vote Georgia number 1 over Texas just because Georgia's been winning it. It was close, though, Texas 2. Ole Miss 3. I think that's fair. A&M 4. We'll see. LSU 5, we'll see. Bama 6th, we'll see. 7th, Oklahoma. 8th, Tennessee. Florida 9th. Missouri 10th. I would not pick Florida over Missouri. You don't pick them over South Carolina, that's fine. 11th, the Gamecocks. 12th, Auburn. 13th, Vandy. 14th, Kentucky. 15th, Mississippi State. 16th, Arkansas. All right, so here's my bottom group. I had Mississippi State 13th, Kentucky 14th, Vandy 15th, Mississippi State, I mean, in Arkansas 16th. I mean, Diego Pavia was such an important player for them, and I know Jared Curtis is supposed to be really good, but, I mean, I don't think he's that good. I don't think he's good enough to elevate Vanderbilt like Diego did. And that's nothing against them. A lot of respect for Clark Lee and all that. Kentucky not being higher surprised me a little bit. I think there's some hype around them being better than expected. You know, Mississippi State's just out of habit. I think they nailed it putting Arkansas last, which I feel bad about. But
yeah,
you know, a lot of this is just like, oh my God, we can't have these guys lower than whatever. And oh my God, you know, there's a little bit less of that this year, though. I think, I don't know. It's just kind of crazy. So.
Yeah, it's not like we're going to be able to get a breakdown of justifications and things, but I'm with you. I think Kentucky might be a little low. I think Mississippi State might be a little low. No, I'm not like so terrified of them. I think they should be, you know, in the top half or anything. There's a couple of spots above that. I could easily justify slotting Mississippi State ahead of Vanderbilt.
Yeah, I mean, so Vandy's getting a lot of credit for last year and then the recruiting win, which that don't never. I learned my lesson 1 year. So when the Wonstash, Dave Wonstash was at Pitt,
the Wonstash.
One summer at rivals.com, right? Pitt, I think Pitt was still in the Big East at the time. They killed it in recruiting. Like, they got all these dudes from Western PA. You'd think Johnny Majors, Jackie Sherrill, Tony Dorsett, Bram Dan Marino, Hugh Green were back, right? And so I think we projected that when we were doing our picks for the conferences, because Rivals at the time was strictly recruiting, basically, and then a little bit of college football. And so we picked Pitt like 4th. Bro, they lost to like Miami of Ohio in the opener. And they were just god awful. And you know, the recruits stuck and they ended up being okay down the road. But you know, the Jared Curtis win, yeah, okay, that'll help, but that ain't gonna help this year. Mm-mm. Not replacing Poppy and not in that system. You know, that system is what made Vandy go hard to defend. And Pavia had ran it for 4 years. And by the time he was done, he was killing it. It's very nuanced. And plus, Jared Curtis is a different type of quarterback. Jared Curtis is 4 or 5 inches taller than Diego.
Yeah.
Not as good of a runner, a better passer, arm slot wise. But so what you're asking yourself is Vandy going to be able to sit back there and pass pro if they're going to drop? Is that what the kill zone wants to do? You know, I mean, there's a lot of questions about Vanderbilt. I think they'll be pretty salty and tough on defense. But, I mean, you're asking, you know, and I know we're kind of – we're talking about the 13th through 16th picks here. So I just don't – I don't get it. You know, Will Stein, here's my question about him. He got up at SEC Media Days. It kind of reminded me of Derek Mason, speaking of Vanderbilt. And said, because of me, you know, great. Okay, so every offensive coordinator Oregon has had for how many years has been really good. Even Willie Taggart had a decent offense out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even Smoking Willie. Got the that's his nickname. I don't know why. Call him Smoking Willie Taggart. Smoking Willie had a good offense. You know, everybody out there's had a good offense. I mean, they get skill talent from all over the country. Good, fast players. They all want to play. It's the wings on the helmet, I think. But, I mean, so, and I'm not downplaying him. I think he's an excellent play caller and all that. But he's not calling plays. He's I'm not calling plays. We've been through this here, right, many times. We know that it matters, and it does. Joe Sloan's calling plays, the LSU coordinator that got fired in the middle of the season last year. and Sloan's pretty good when he's got players, and you know he's pretty good working under Skip Holtz at Louisiana Tech. But I mean, you know, like I don't know if it was Brad Crawford or somebody mentioned him as Shane's next coordinator when he became available. And I was like, no, how about no? No. Because I could just see it. You know, I was like, it's not going to work. Ugh. But it's not a difference maker. And then who do we have? Dave Bartu?
Yeah.
They called Jace, was it Spearman? He used to be at Army in North Carolina, the D coordinator. He called him the worst defensive coordinator in college football.
Worst coordinator.
Now, I thought the guy did a pretty good job at Army. And I kind of, you know, there was word that Beamer was kind of talking to him and stuff before he hired Clayton White. You know, things didn't end well at UNC. I mean, you know, and then they replaced him with Jeff Collins, who gave up 70 points to James Madison. And at home. And you know, so you kind of look at it and you're like, well, are those really coaching upgrades from what you had? Now, Bush Hamden or whatever his name was, the last coordinator, the final pro style savior that Mark Stoops brought in there.
Right.
He was god awful. He was god awful. He was worse than anybody they've ever had.
Which is saying something.
But Brad White, I'm going to tell you this right now, Brad White is now back in the state of Florida working with, I think John Summerall actually played or coached for Brad White at Kentucky. Summerall's a Kentucky guy. You watch, Florida's defense will improve this year. He's a good coach. Coaching matters, you know, and if you're a head coach and you have a strength and you're like an overwhelming strength. Like the reason Will Stein got that job is because he's a good play caller. And you just say, I'm not going to do it. And better yet, I'm giving it up to some guy that's got a mediocre track record that couldn't move the ball at LSU. And he's going to move it at Kentucky. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, I'm looking at this stuff that we got sent over and – I cannot fathom Oklahoma at 7. Matt,
hold on. Repeat yourself because you froze.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking over this stuff from, you know, SEC media days and the media poll. Like, I'm sorry, but I don't know how Oklahoma is number seven. Like, that is just, that is ridiculous. They have probably the best defense in the country. They have John Mateer, who's going to be much better than he was last year. And it's another thing where we talk about Diego Pavia, to bring him back to Vanderbilt, JC, and years in the system, just years in the system. And if you think that Oklahoma is going to be seventh, I mean, they're going to be better than LSU. They're going to be better than Texas A&M. And they might be better than Ole Miss. Like, I see Oklahoma as a top three team, and I could be crazy, but man, defense wins. What?
Let's look at their schedule, shall we?
Yes.
Right, yeah. So maybe, because maybe it's a schedule thing. Let's not trash our media.
Well, they have a tough one. I mean, they play Utah, then at Michigan.
Tough opener.
New Mexico. Now. Who's New Mexico? Is Jason X still coaching New Mexico?
Let's see.
I think he is. Or maybe he got one of those California jobs. New Mexico's been through a tough time because they've been competitive, but it's not been.
Yeah, it's still Eck.
Eck's a good coach, but yeah. Oklahoma will handle them.
Yeah.
But that UTEP opener scares me. Friday night in Norman.
Friday night. I know, yeah.
The UTEP Miners at Michigan. I don't know what to make of Michigan. Half the people you talk to about Michigan say Kyle Whittingham's the best coach in America. He's going to win a national championship.
Are they all Michigan fans?
Nah, they're more Kyle Whittingham fans, which is yeah. good. But look, man, I'll say this. Sometimes guys that are at a place for a long, long time and are winning go to another place that you think they will win even better at, and they don't. Mike Riley was that way. Mike Riley was the best coaches. He made Oregon State competitive, and they were – Mike Riley built that thing and was good. I remember he was up for the Alabama job for a while. Well, finally he left and went to Nebraska. Disaster for 3 years. Made them even worse, okay? So sometimes that works out, sometimes it doesn't. It's still at the Big House. It's still a big noon kickoff. I'm still wondering about Oklahoma's offense. They did have a lot of young offensive linemen last year that'll be better, you know. So my scenario I'm thinking is Oklahoma's defense completely overwhelms them.
That's my thinking. They don't have to score 25. They can win 21-17,
20-13. And then I think, you know, adapting to a new, because, you know, Sherrone Moore, all he did was basically continue what Harbaugh was doing. They got new systems, new players.
And Venables is going to have the entire offseason to game plan for Michigan because he's not worried about UTEP.
Well, he's going to, speaking of Jason, not Jason Eck, but Beck, the OC from Utah, he went with Whittingham. So he's their OC. He's pretty good. So then you got New Mexico, the Lobos, and then you go at Georgia. But then you have an off week before you play Texas. Now, this is the year Oklahoma will probably win that game because it seems to go back and forth every other year. Then Kentucky comes to town. Then at Mississippi State. So then South Carolina. Then at Florida. Then Ole Miss comes in. A&M comes in. Then at Missouri. So the SEC made this huge deal out of the Missouri-Arkansas game being a rivalry, right? But now – No, it's going to be Missouri-Oklahoma on Thanksgiving weekend. Arkansas is going to play Texas. Okay, whatever. Or Arkansas is going to play somebody else. But anyway.
I see two losses maybe. I see two
I don't, maybe. Yeah, I mean, you know, you've got Kentucky, Mississippi State, and, you know, Georgia, Texas. I mean, your road it's a home road balance. So their road games in conference are Georgia, they go to Starkville, they go to Florida, and they go to Missouri. That's favorable, dude.
It's very favorable.
Yeah. So then everybody else is coming to town. You know, Lane Kiffin and his crew knew how to dice up Venables' defense. Is John David Baker going to be able to do that? I don't know. You know. It does play pretty favorably to them. So why would they be seventh?
I have no clue. It makes zero sense.
You know, ahead of you know, and I know LSU being fifth, I know people aren't really, you know, buying the hype, you know what I'm saying? With the roster, because I think there's been some intel pumped out there that, hey, this is not going to be their best roster. You know, A&M ahead of them.
Mm-mm.
You know, here's my question about Texas A&M, and then we're going to get back on the Gamecocks point, okay? Because there is a Gamecock here. So Elko lost his two coordinators. Now, I don't think Mike Elko honestly needs – I mean, you know, somebody thinks Jay Bateman's the worst D coordinator in college football. Okay. Well, he's Elko's D coordinator the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, who's really running that defense? Mike Elko. He's elite. Brent Venables, Mike Elko, I think, are the two – and Kirby Smart are the three best defensive coordinating head coaches of the league. And so, say Elko is running. It doesn't matter. He promoted from within on defense. Who cares? Lyle Hemphill, I think, is the guy. Offensively, though, which is where you can get into trouble if you're a defensive-minded coach, as we found out here, right, Matt? Matt, pay attention. Matthew.
Matt. Right here.
Yeah, but you didn't say anything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, right.
Now. You're looking off into space. Like,
no, I'm trying to look at Elko's defenses over the past couple of years at A&M to see.
Pretty salty.
Oh, he's running the numbers in real time. I love it.
Yeah,
I'm trying to. I love that. Okay, so he promoted a guy named, I think, Holman Wiggins, who's never been a play caller at any level. I remember Holman was at Virginia Tech for a year under Scott Loeffler, which that name, when I talk about offensive football excellence, escapes me.
Holman Wiggins.
And Holman Wiggins. But he's a journeyman. He's got a great reputation as a coach. But he's getting the opportunity to go call it. Okay, so their OC the last couple of years has been Colin Klein, who went back to Kansas State, and who that K-State system, they run a little bit of option. They can throw. It's a really good system that they've run through the years. And Colin Klein was a K-State quarterback and all that. I thought he did a fantastic job at Texas A&M. So now you're handing it over to this guy, and then you start to read, well, we're going to do some – because I'm convinced, too, pro-style offenses, power runs, defensive coordinators love those. They're like, we love that. That's our style of offense.
Well, it's complimentary football. Of course
they love it. But it definitely comes – but, you know, run the ball. And so if I'm an A&M fan, I'm going – and then I watched a preview on them the other day. Marcel Reed and then this – and Mario – and this guy and that guy. You know, got to be concerned about the offensive line. Got to replace some there. You don't just – here's another thing we know with the Gamecocks. You don't just say – now they've got to find an offensive line and get away with it. We also know this: when you pressure Marcel Reed,
bad things do not happen
good for him. So my question is this guy just going to keep it going with what's been successful for them, with what Reed's thrived in and those receivers and all that? Or are we going to see some, hey, let's do a bunch of substitution patterns, go really slow, grind it out with an offensive line we had to repair with Trevon Ball? Have we seen how the power run game works with that guy? The pro style power run game. I mean, I think sometimes you can mess it up with coaching. A&M's immensely talented. They probably got more NFL guys than outside of Texas and Georgia than anybody. But man, I wouldn't trust it. And I do think, Mike Elko's gotten his flowers all offseason. And I agree. He is an excellent coach. But I also have seen really, really excellent coaches screw it up six ways from Sunday by making a poor coordinator hire. And when we get back, Phil and Matt, we're going to have a discussion.
Okay.
I'm done talking. I'm not done talking, but I'm going to let you guys talk. We're going to talk about some examples through the years of when you go in a new direction on offense and it's good, like quote unquote dynamic you're a little bit more creative, aggressive, and fun. How it's worked. And we've had examples at South Carolina. And we've also had examples of how it not hasn't worked when you've gone the other direction. But there's some other examples. And I mentioned up at Clemson, there's some Clemson examples of this. You know, there's some Alabama examples of this. There's some, you know, I think this is, we've spent a long time today talking about Bryles. One of the reasons is I think it's one of the storylines everybody's kind of missing about this whole thing. All right. We'll be back. Friday episode of the show rolls on.
Welcome back, everybody. Inside the Gamecocks, the show rolling on here. JC, you'll be back here in just a second. Just a second. This is some interesting stuff here. I was, are you surprised, Matt, to not see Lenora Sellers on this list, even third team? I'm quite frankly not at this
point. I'm not surprised, Phil, but at the same time, like, I will never understand the national media's ability to just live like a goldfish. Like, first team all SEC last year, and well documented the offensive struggles, and the offensive coordinator got fired. You know, everyone in the world had Lenora Sellers as a top five NFL draft pick, and one season and it's blink, and Trinidad Chambliss is the new face of football with a flash in the pan season. I can't understand it. But at the same time, I don't expect anything more, certainly not anything more from the national media covering, 117 D1 football programs and really only focusing on 40 of them. And South Carolina finished outside of the top 40 last year. So there's nobody that's even thought about South Carolina until it came time to, oh, let me fill out this poll here and let me look at last year's stats. Who's still here? And who's projected to go in the NFL draft? Oh, yeah, let me write their name down because I've never heard their name until today, but it seems like a good idea. Groupthink is
there's a lot of voters, though. I mean, it's
there's a lot of voters that shouldn't have a vote, JC. You know that.
And you know, but that's why I'm surprised Georgia got more points than Texas, because Texas has a large media contingent, just like everything else. So, but.
Well, I wish, JC, maybe we should do this, but Gary Parrish, who I think is one of the – he's a pretty good college basketball guy, national guy. He used to do poll attacks, and every single Monday the poll would come out, and they actually post what media member voted which way. And he would call five or six of them out and be like, you realize that such and such team hasn't won a game in 2 weeks and you still rank them 11th. Like, we have to do better as a media group. And – I think that transparency is needed, and call people out if they're going to be silly.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, well, the football poll, especially, that's that one guy from the Cleveland Plain Dealer that hates the SEC that in 24 was just insane. But I mean, look, man, it the problem is when the media narrative influences the, I don't want to say simpletons, but the people on the College Football Playoff Committee. Until it gets down to a binary choice they have to make, and then they have to do work. It's like, and it, you know, they flip a coin most of the time.
And that binary choice starts at like team 11 because they have a top 10 in front of them.
Yeah.
And they have the automatic qualifiers just, in front of them.
Yeah. It's crazy how the sport works sometimes. So anyway, back to coaching. Actually, so I mentioned earlier, like, so here's some examples of complicated versus not complicated. Okay. And I'll use Clemson. So I mentioned Rich Rod came in, right? And great. And then Rich Rod left for West Virginia. So Bowden promoted Brad Scott, who actually is a pretty good play caller at the end of the day. And then Mike O'Kane, who was kind of more of a pro style guy. And then that was 03. And then they went on that tear at the end of the season, had a really good looking offense. Charlie Whitehurst, Dwayne Coleman. Derek Hamilton. I mean, they were rolling up and down the field. They beat Carolina badly. They beat Florida State, and then they beat Tennessee. Tennessee didn't really lose. Tennessee was actually good back then at the Peach Bowl, and it wasn't really particularly close. So then in his genius, Tommy decides, and this was his downfall. You know, offensive guy. He was an offensive coordinator. that O'Kane's really going to call the plays now. We're going to move Brad Scott to offensive line coach. Okay. The next year, they went 6-5. Well, that was the fight year. Didn't go to a bowl. All that good stuff. So that was it for, I believe. Yeah, that was it. 04 was it for O'Kane. He got fired. And so then they go and hire the mad scientist, Rob Spence. Now, all we heard from Clemson people, and this was between 04 and 05. So Spurrier got hired at Carolina, and everybody at Carolina was like, well, probably going to at least be competent on offense now. You know, not that the 04 team wasn't, but, you know, Steve Spurrier, he's going to manufacture offense, and he did. He did. All we heard from Clemson people was when they talk about who the next Norm Chow is, it's Rob Spence, the mad scientist. And that offense had some good days because they had really good players like Charlie Whiter, C.J. Spiller, James Davis, really, really fantastic receivers. I mean, they recruited pretty well. It had some bad days. And look, man, they ended up he would not get rid of him, you know. And what I heard was it was so complicated and so specific, and it kind of worked at Toledo and the MAC, but the Clemson guys just were like, their minds were blown by it. You know, he'd spend an hour workshopping the snap from center. I mean, the guy just wasn't very good. Didn't make sense, right? Probably would work at like a Holy Cross or someplace like that. So the first thing Dabo does is fire him. And Billy Napier replaces him as the play caller. Now, we found out in time, Billy Napier's not all that great of a play caller, right? But guess what? Guess what Clemson's offense did when he took over? It got much better. Much better. And then the next year, they won the ACC for the first time in 20 years with who's calling plays? Billy Napier. Cal Parker was really became really good all of a sudden. And, you know, it just – so there's an example there at Clemson, right, where that happened. You go from complex to a little bit simpler and more freeing, and it works. The Arkansas example, Dan Enos. And that's a guy with a great reputation in college. Saban was going to hire him as his OC. I mean, he's really accomplished. RPO guy. Same personnel, right, essentially, that Kendall had. And that offense was a disaster. They ended up replacing him with a wide receivers coach, Kenny Guyton. I don't think he's called a play since. They go to the Swamp. Rocket Sanders just so happens to have his best day, 135 yards. KJ looks like KJ. They beat Florida at the Swamp. Billy Napier's team, ironic. That's a recent example. I just think that, you know, when you've got an offensive system that's bogged your players down, and that it just doesn't work. It's just clunky, and something's not working. It's always best to go in the polar opposite direction. And I think this is exactly what Shane Beamer's done with Kendall Briles. And Matt, you've got an article coming out if I ever find the right slot for it, because it's so good. I don't want to just put it up on a Friday afternoon, right? We've been talking about this. Some examples of where when head coaches have said, all right, we're not going to do this anymore. We're going to go do this because this works on offense specifically. Fortunes have changed, and in two cases, very dramatically.
Well, I'll add on to that, JC. When you get into that situation as a head coach, something drastic has to happen, right? And you have to make a change that's polar opposite to maybe even your head coaching ideals, because what you've been trying to do isn't working, hasn't worked, and it's your job now on the line. And we've seen it blow up in coaches' faces, but we've also seen it be very, very successful. And when it's very, very successful, JC and Phil, what you find is points per game go up by like 7, 8, 9 points per game. Yards per pass attempt go up 2 or 3 yards per pass attempt. Rushing yards per attempt go up 1 or 1 to 2 yards. And you actually see a transformation that happens, and it lasts for a little bit. You know, I've said for a long time, I think eventually Josh Heupel is going to get figured out. Every coach does at some point. But being creative and then also being flexible is what makes the best head coach the best head coach. I mean, Nick Saban won for years with the same system. And guess what? He realized this ain't working. And JC, maybe that's somebody we need to put in the piece as well, where we can talk about, you know, sustained success and still changing things up. It's just, you know, college football and the NFL are copycat leagues, and too many head coaches try and become an NFL franchise and saying this will work because it works at the highest level. And in college, there's just too many instances of a DB slipping and all of a sudden it's a 40-yard touchdown pass, or a defensive tackle not wrapping up Lenore Sellers and Lenore Sellers scampering in 16 yards for a touchdown to take the lead. Like, you cannot play the analytics and the odds in college like you can in the NFL, is my takeaway.
Yeah, I mean, you got to, it's about attacking more in the amateur football, like high school and college level. I mean, high schools attack in multiple ways. Some of them still run the wing T and things like that, you know, to get into any advantage you can. In the pros, you're not really getting you've got playmakers, right, that are hard to stop at that level. And you've got an advantage whenever you have one, but you still can't just, yeah, that's why you don't really see NFL, you know, if you have an NFL team, like the running, remember the run and shoot, you had the Jerry Glanville with the Falcons and Oilers, June Jones, you had that offense, and then it eventually just, you know, petered out. And that happens in that league. I think the best play callers, the guys like Andy Reid and guys like that, have imagination within structure, but they still have that structure, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're still not out there just attacking, because you're going to attack something so many times. I mean, they're just going to adjust, and then you don't have a guy that you can pick on all day. You have an elite athlete, one of the best athletes in the world, that's going to go over there and knock your receiver.
Well, that's why Spurrier didn't succeed in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, you can't do that. And it's like, you can't count on the other guy being bad. And then you also have to, you do have to trick them. There is some clandestine stuff, but it's a slow, gradual process, right? Now, I'll say this about those guys too. They can coach. They can, because one of the things like last year, the Bengals played the Bears. Nobody was going to, the Bears had some injuries during the game. Nobody was stopping anybody that day. And you know what? It was a play calling duo. The Bears ended up winning like 46-43. That was a thing of beauty. I mean, there's no college offensive display that I've seen that's that wild and creative and awesome, and guys running wide open in different formations and boom, boom. Ben Johnson versus Zach Taylor, I think, is the Bengals coach. Mm-hmm. They're just dialing them up, dude, because the defense has allowed them to do that. They don't allow you to do that at that level. You need to run it. You need to have time of possession. It's just how it is. College isn't that way. You try to do that in college, you better have overwhelming talent, which Saban did.
Yeah.
But then Lane Kiffin comes in because I think McElwain got the Colorado State job and left. So Kiffin comes in, and then their quarterback situation was a little iffy. Jalen Hurts won the job as a true freshman. And they're like, all right, let's roll. And then it evolved so much from there. And Saban admitted he had to do it. And so I just look around and I see, you know, just the difference it makes. And you know, in the article, there'll be two examples I talk about often. One was a head coaching change. One was a defensive head coach going in another direction. And that was 10 years ago. But in 13, Auburn played for the national title, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Does anybody know what Auburn's record was the year before?
Not good.
Yeah, not good. In
the 12, aforementioned but... Scott Loeffler was dialing the plays up. And Brian Van Gorder was the D coordinator, right? 3-9. You know what their SEC record was? 0-8. You know, Carolina's was 1-7 last year, and we talk about how close they were in several games. That Auburn team wasn't close, guys. That was that Auburn team, you know, considering that, you know, they had played for a national title or won a national title 2 years before. And Gus Malzahn hadn't been gone that long, dude. Mm-hmm. He was gone 1 year, right? And that Auburn team under a national championship winning head coach and a guy like Brian Van Gorder, who was a veteran coordinator, supposed to be, you know, pretty good, had better years at Notre Dame, obviously, when he got back in. So that Auburn team lost to Clemson by 7. Clemson bragged about beating them, by the way. And then Mississippi State, 28-10, they lost. They beat Louisiana Monroe by 3 points in overtime. Their defense decided to play against LSU in the hat. They lost 12-10. Then the beating started. Arkansas 24-7. At Ole Miss 41-20. At Vandy, a good but not great Vandy team under James Franklin 17-13. A&M came to Auburn. And this is when after the Vandy loss, when they lost their sixth game, this is when the beating started. A&M 63, Auburn 21. In 2012. That was the Johnny football team. They did this also shows you what the Diego Pavia miracle. I guess this was the first of the two game series they had signed with New Mexico State. They did beat New Mexico State 42-7. They beat Alabama A&M later that year too, but listen to the SEC games. So after the 63-21 beatdown, they played Georgia at home 38-0. And then at Alabama, 49-0 in Saban, call it off the dogs. 3-9, 0-8. All right. The next year, 13. They had trouble. I mean, they really, Gus was kind of the third or fourth choice for the job. They brought him back. They struggled with Washington State and Mike Leach first game, but they won. They beat Arkansas State. They beat Mississippi State close. They lost to LSU. Everything was kind of normal. You know, Nick Marshall had. So they beat Ole Miss at home. They beat Western Carolina. They win a shootout at A&M. Johnny Football's on that team as well. They beat FAU. They beat Arkansas's butt. They beat Tennessee 55-23. It started rolling. Then they had the two miracle wins, Georgia and Bama, beat Missouri in the SEC championship. Averaged 30-something, 40-something points a game the whole time, and then almost beat Florida State. So that's how that mattered. You know, they went back to what they were good at scheme-wise, and it made all the difference in the world, because it's really, outside of Nick Marshall, who was a JUCO quarterback recruit, it's the same group of guys. Same group of guys. So, I mean, to me, I'm like, well, that's kind of what you should be doing if your offense is such a problem. I'll give you one more example. And we'll go to TCU for that example. Gary Patterson, my boy, who I still can't believe they fired. But that guy that fired him is the AD at Carolina now, so I need to shut up. So they got the Big 12, right, and they went 4-8, okay, just like Carolina. Beat a bad Iowa State team, beat Kansas. That was the extent of it. And just wasn't working. Right. And they couldn't score in the Big 12. And at that point in time, there was no defense being played in the Big 12. So Gary Patterson says, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're just going to go do what everybody else is doing. And we're going to, you know, spread it out and throw it, and like most Texas schools do. Bro, they went 11-1.
That's the video game number season.
The only loss was to Art Briles and Kendall Briles and Baylor by 3 points. You know, rolled through everybody, beat Texas on the road 48-10 at the end of the year. Iowa State 55, they beat Oklahoma at home by 7. Still pretty salty on defense. Then they played Hugh Freeze and Ole Miss, the 9th-ranked team in the country, in the Peach Bowl. That's when, you know, bowl games still mattered. Nobody was opting out. They beat Ole Miss 42-3. I mean, what kind of difference did that make? They were 4-8 the year before. 4-8. Couldn't score. So I don't know, man. There is, for those of you that think just because there was 4-8 last year that it can't turn around, there's examples you know, we've come a long way since the Gamecocks went from 0-11 to 8-4, and it was the biggest turnaround ever. There have been turnarounds since then. And most of the time, guys, it's because a head coach has said, I'm going to fix my offense.
Yeah, I mean, it's no sure thing. Like, kick my desk there. But it's no sure thing that it's going to happen. But, you know, we keep laying out all these data points. Jamie's done it. JC's done it. Phil's talked about it. I've put it out there. Like, there are reasons for optimism. Now, we'll see what happens in 2026. But if I had to lay my chips on something, I would lay my chips on it working out for South Carolina and South Carolina fans being quite happy about it. Because, you know, aside from, you know, the coaching staff, aside from the data points, and this is Shane's record here, when this happens, how many points you need to score in the SEC, South Carolina has a 50% blue chip ratio. They have good players. And for the first time in a long time, when we specifically talk about offense, they have a college offense and scheme with a coach that's very, very familiar with running it. And people do not discount Randy Clements and his impact on this offense as well, because in a Bryles offense, they're not asked to block for 5 seconds. They're asked to do their job just for X amount of time, and the quarterback has to make that read. And I feel confident that these two guys, Bryles and Clements, have done it long enough together. And with the talent that's on the offense, it should equate to something. Like, as Phil and I were talking about when we came on after the break, Lenore Sellers is still the same guy who was first team all SEC in the preseason last year and a top five draft pick. He's still the same guy. He didn't regress if you look at the data points. He was just under more pressure last year and forced to play in a scheme that honestly didn't fit his skill set. So, like, don't discount the Gamecocks this year, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons that I didn't quite understand not even catching. I mean, I know why, because there's bigger names, and they got plenty of, you know, darlings this year under center in the SEC. But, I mean, there is – kind of like you said, JC, there is no consideration whatsoever for the offensive change heading into this.
You don't even hear about it.
Perspective. Like, no, like, I don't even know if I heard Kendall Briles' name mentioned at SEC Media Days.
Whereas, when Clemson got Garrett Riley – now, look, Clemson was in a much – Clemson won't come off a 4-8 record.
Yeah.
I believe they won the ACC championship in 2022. Didn't they? Yeah. When they got rid of, because that was the Carolina beat them, but then they went and beat North Carolina the next week badly for the ACC title. But then Garrett Riley coming over from, you know, TCU and their good run. And he, you know, his last name's Riley or whatever, and everybody shut off fireworks. Kendall Bryles has almost been like an afterthought when people are talking about it. And except by people like Cole Kublik,
who
understand, you know. Here's my thing, and this is super positive, but it's Friday. We're going to end on a positive note because there's negatives too.
That's right.
There's negatives too. Here's the positive thing. I talked earlier about putting the defense in conflict, which Carolina rarely did. There was no conflict, you know. I would be really freaked out a little if I were even the best D coordinator, because D coordinators hate tempo. They can't, you know, you just got to sit there and can't sub. I couldn't sub, and then I got to worry about this freakazoid quarterback running on me or throwing it to take your pick of fast receivers that can house it. You know, if the backs are improved, that kind of thing. You know, you can't. What are you going to do if you spy Lenora Sellers? He's just going to, with the way Bryles' offense works, he's just going to be out pattern after out, in pattern. You know, he's just going to keep throw it past you, right? And hit the open space. If you just blitz the crap. Now, if you're blitzing the crap out of them and getting them home consistently, like if your line is really getting destroyed, you know, there are ways to combat that with draw plays and things like that. But if they're in the backfield all day, it's not going to be a good day. But I just, you know, in theory, with what he does and the players you've got, and then what it, the problems it causes a D coordinator. And then you throw in the fact when Lenore Sellers is playing in rhythm or the, aligned with the operational tempo of the game, Phil, that he's so much better than when he's not. I mean, I don't know. I'm optimistic about, I'll just say I'm optimistic about the plan. Players have to play, coaches have to coach. Game day is different, but and I guess my thing would be I'm surprised there hadn't at least been more discussion. I mean, tell me why it wouldn't work out.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, yeah, that's the that's the thing that I find baffling is I was like, why is this not going to be better than it is than it was last year, right? And, and I think that even any lay person could see that it's a better system that is going to benefit him maybe more so than anybody on this team outside of the O-line with the way they're going to be able to communicate and function and not have to think, you know, so much before pre-snap. But yeah, I just, it is what it is. Obviously we kind of like the underdog role around here. It's something that Shane Beamer plays up whenever he gets an opportunity to do so. All three players mentioned that in their media availabilities this week in Tampa. So, yeah, it's got them right where you want them, at least from a mentality standpoint.
Yeah,
there aren't five teams in the SEC that would keep their quarterback over Lenore Sellers. Like, if they had the option, they're all going to pick Lenore Sellers. Not all of them. I mean, obviously you have – some established guys, but he's top four in the SEC bare minimum.
Sweet.
Behind Byron Brown. That's a joke. I did not. I don't think
that. Look, Byron Brown, though, I just got to get stats, right? It's kind of like Mateer coming in last year.
Right.
Stats. Mm-hmm. He had 3,100 passing yards and 1,000 rushing. And that's a system. Again, the system. That's Josh Heupel's system. That's worked. I mean, we'd all be quaking in our boots about Big Orange.
Big Orange.
If Byron Brown had gone to Tennessee, wouldn't we?
Yeah, they didn't shell out that kind of money. They're buying, you know, they're buying freshmen. They're not buying.
They're going to play a freshman at quarterback. Right. I tell you, if this running back is legit and Fazion Brandon ends up being legit, Tennessee could. I mean, they could. I'm going to give them credit. I think they could. You got – with that system and those players, and then
it's the defensive coordinator making those changes coming from Penn State. Like, that defense has, that secondary has to get fixed.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes Knowles
defense.
The word is, though, it takes Knowles a little while. You know, Tennessee, though, had as many, like, one less non-offensive touchdown last year than Carolina. Like, wow. I think they led the league in pick sixes, and everybody talked about that secondary. I mean, they got torched.
Flip side of the coin, maybe the offense wasn't as good as Heupel has been accustomed to.
I'll say this, though. We've talked a lot about points. You know, if Carolina does run a lot of tempo and it's fast on offense, don't think that Clayton White suddenly forgot how to coordinate a defense because the Gamecocks are giving up more touchdowns. That happened in Alabama, too, when they went tempo.
Yeah.
They started, you know, it's just – there's more possessions, more opportunities. It's kind of a math thing. Matt will probably write something about that.
Probably.
Well, especially over the next 2 weeks while we have nothing. We're just digging for things to write.
That's right. The dead zone.
All righty. Sweet. All right, guys. For the late night game cut, Matt Anderson. For Mad Dog. For Jamie Bradford. This is JC Sherbert. This has been the show. And we'll be back Monday. Y'all, I'll let you boys see you.
See ya.